Good evening. Thanks to the Milley Center, thanks to Eugene Rogan for the invitation, and thanks to Thomas for the fabulous presentation. It's very kind of you. You said you're my friend, so I guess everyone knows at this point that you don't believe anything that you said, because this is just friendship. but thank you. I'll start my talk with the description of three events that happened in Egypt more or less at the same time, and that was in April 2012. So we're going back a little while. April 2012 was the run-up to Egypt's first presidential post-revolution election, and the country was boiling with politics. In Cairo, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi was organizing his last big electoral meeting in Abdeen, next to the former royal palace. And the lineup for the event was striking, some would say surprising. Mohamed Morsi did, of course, give a full speech. He was the candidate. But before and after, the show was run by two sheikhs, both of whom were clearly identified with Salafism. Mohamed Abdel Maqsoud, a prominent Salafi figure from Cairo's Shubra neighborhoods, and Safwat Hegazi, who was a member of what became known in the 2000s as the Muslim Brotherhood's Salafi wing. Outside the electoral meeting, as you left the place, the books of Raghib al-Sharjani, another sheikh and member of the Brotherhood Salafi wing, were being sold on large tables. One of those was on the life of Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab. Another one argued that the Brotherhood was a Salafi organization and that Salafis should support it. In that lineup, Sheikh Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who until the 2000s had been considered as the Muslim Brotherhood's global mufti, to quote from Jakob Skovgaard Peterson, well, he was nowhere to be found. He was completely absent. And indeed, while remaining in Qatar, he actually never officially backed Mohamed Morsi. Around the same time as this was happening with Mohamed Morsi, Abdel Munim Abdel Futuh was a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood who had left the organization and had decided to run for president. And as you know, he would end up fourth with 17% of the vote. So Abdel Futuh was organizing his own electoral meeting in Alexandria with the support of Egypt's biggest Salafi organization, the Dawah Salafiyah. All of this was happening as the streets of Cairo were recovering from clashes in front of the army's headquarters, led by supporters of another Salafi sheikh, Hazem Salah Abu Ismail. A maverick Salafi, Hazem, had decided to run for president, and an enormous social movement had taken shape around his bid. In early 2012, the streets of Egypt's main cities were full of posters for Hazem, and some of the early polls ranked him first among all presidential candidates. It was his exclusion from the presidential race in early April by Egypt's Electoral Commission on the grounds of the alleged dual American-Egyptian citizenship of his mother that prompted the clashes with his supporters. I'm telling those stories because they reflect how in the post-revolutionary period, Salafism had become the dominant and unavoidable religious idiom in Egyptian politics. An idiom even adopted by groups and individuals that historically had had little to do with Salafism, starting with the Muslim Brotherhood. How did this come to be? And what consequences did this have for Egypt's political transition? My argument here is that in Egypt, 2011 was the culmination of two parallel and completely distinct processes that collided in the wake of the revolution. The first of these processes is well known and now well studied. It is the political process that led a mostly young generation of activists, most of whom had little to do with Islamism and even less with Salafism, to trigger a succession of events that would end with the ouster of Hosni Mubarak on the 11th of February. But the second of those processes is much less studied and took place within a much longer time frame. That process is what I called the hegemonization of Salafism within Egypt's religious sphere. Explaining how this hegemonization came to be is a daunting task, and I have just finished a book about this. But what I'll do here is that I briefly sum up some of my main arguments. But first, let's start by defining Salafism and explaining why it needs to be considered as a phenomenon analytically distinct from the Muslim Brotherhood's Islamism. In the Egyptian context, Islamism and Salafism both emerged in the 1920s in an organized form as two possible outcomes of the movement of Islamic reform that had taken hold in the country since the late 19th century. Established in 1928, the Muslim Brotherhood was Islamism's first organized manifestation, and it would remain the matrix of Islamism throughout the 20th century. What is less known, though, is that 2 years before, in 1926, Egypt's first Salafi organization had been established, Ansar Sunnah al-Muhammadiyya, the supporters of the Prophet's tradition. And from now on, I will call them Ansar al-Sunnah, as they usually call them, the Egyptian debates. The two organizations, the Brothers and Ansar al-Sunnah, would remain at odds for all of their history. And although Ansar al-Sunnah was smaller than the Brotherhood in size, both organizations would come to exert a massive influence over Egyptian society. Salafism here can be defined as both a religious discourse, and initially at least, as what I refer to as a grammar of action. In terms of religious discourse, Salafism represents a ultra-conservative version of Islam, inspired by a select number of medieval and more modern authors, from Ibn Taymiyyah and his students Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah and Ibn Kathir, to Muhammad bin Abdul Wahhab, the co-founder of Saudi Arabia, and his later intellectual heirs. What characterizes Salafi religious discourse is its strict and uncompromising definition of the Muslim creed, the Aqidah. Based on that definition, the adherents of Islam's dominant theological school, the Asharis, proponents of the Ashari school, but also the Sufis, and of course the Shia, all of those are not considered to be proper Muslims, and sometimes not Muslim at all. That attitude on creeds goes with a ultra-conservative reading in fiqh, supporting a set of social practices that would become seen in the 20th century as distinctively Salafi, for instance regarding women, who most, but not actually all Salafis, consider should cover their faces in public, of music, which is banned except for a cappella chants, the famous nasheeds, or anasheed in plural form, or regarding Christians, for instance, whom, according to Salafis, it is forbidden to congratulate on their religious holidays. And you would see that in Egypt, you'd see the Brotherhood putting up signs congratulating Christians on Christmas, but Salafis wouldn't do that. So, you know, those are practices that would distinctively set Salafis apart. This ultra-conservative religious discourse often goes with what I've called a distinctive grammar of action. And I'm using that term, I'm borrowing it from pragmatic sociology, authors like Vincent Lemieux, Luc Boltanski, etc. Salafis believe that the reform of the Ummah should happen primarily through the purification of the creed and the propagation of the purified creed through education and preaching. This is what a later and very famous Salafi figure, Sheikh Muhammad Nasser al-Din al-Albani, called at-tasfiyah wa-tarbiyah, purification and education. This explains why Salafis have generally shunned oppositional politics. For them, no change can come from above before society has been religiously purified. At the level of both discourse and grammar of action, Salafism is thus distinct from Islamism as represented by the Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood understands reform as fundamentally a political process, one that ends with the creation of an Islamic state, the famous Dawla Islamiyah of the Brotherhood, later taken on by other groups. And that has prompted the Brothers to enter the political sphere as active participants from quite early on in their history. As you remember, Hassan al-Banna himself ran for elections already in the early 1940s. Salafis, in return, see politics as corrupting and unnecessary at this stage. And again, quoting from Sheikh al-Albani, what they say is, "Min as-siyasa tark as-siyasa." The good policy is to abandon politics or to step away from politics. Salafis have thus usually thought a modus vivendi with the different regimes as a way to protect their preaching enterprise. Finally, in terms of Islam, there are also clear differences between Salafis and Brothers. While Salafis see religious reform as their primary goal, as I've said, the Brothers' main focus is political reform. And for the Brothers, Islam is a given, not an ideal to be reached. And the goal for the brothers is therefore to try to unify conservative Muslims across their differences around a common political goal. This is clear from the trajectory of Hassan al-Banna, for instance, who welcomed Sufis, and he was a former Sufi himself, who was active in rapprochement efforts. Taqrib was the Shia, for instance. And that owed him already at the time the harsh criticism of Ansar al-Sunnah Salafis. Explaining what I call the hegemonization of Salafism requires an analysis of the shifting relations within a triangle of actors made up of the state, Islamism, and Salafism, right? That's the triangle I'm looking at. That hegemonization took place in different stages. And I'm going to walk you through these different stages, and I'll have to be quick. Again, that will be much more detailed in the book that will come out next year. From the 1920s to the 1940s, the Egyptian Salafis' main effort was geared towards publishing and thus making accessible to a large audience the writings of a select group of authors that formed the backbone of their corpus. Ibn Taymiyyah, Ibn Qayyim, Ibn Kathir, Muhammad Abdul Wahhab, Sulaiman Ibn Sihman, etc., etc. Most of these authors were little known in Egypt before the 1920s. And when they were generally denounced by the country's dominant Islamic tradition, represented by Al-Azhar. The Salafi effort was thus aimed not only at rehabilitating these authors, but also at saturating the emerging book markets with their writings. The early Egyptian Salafis displayed an impressive entrepreneurial ethos that made their publishing campaign eventually quite successful, despite the radical opposition of Al-Azhar. And at the time, you know, some of the most senior sheikh Al-Azhar are constantly denouncing what they see as the corrupting enterprises of the Salafis who are digging into the tradition to bring out divisive works, etc., etc. That's the language, of course, that is used by some of the most prominent sheikhs of Al-Azhar at the time. Sheikh Dijwi is one of them, but there are many, many names. What Ibn Kathir's famous tafsir, for instance, and everyone today knows Tafsir Ibn Kathir, right? It's the most famous exegesis of the Quran, these days considered so. Well, it was only published in 1924 in Egypt for the first time. And at the time, it was not very known. It would take a few decades for it to become seen as the reference in tafsir, pushing aside Az-Zamakhshari, Al-Baydawi, and Al-Tabari even, who used to be considered until the early 20th century as the core representatives of the genre. Counterintuitively, the coming to power of the Free Officers and later Gamal Abdel Nasser in 1954 turned out to be a blessing for the Salafis. Most of the country's Islamic associations were either banned, like the Muslim Brotherhood, or put under the heavy control of the state. Al-Azhar was also domesticated, especially after the 1961 nationalization law. Among the only organizations that were spared from repression were the Salafi organizations, starting with Ansar al-Sunnah, who, since they shunned institutional politics and did not hesitate to sing the praise of the new regime, were never seen as a threat. In other words, Nasser's religious policies created an immense void in the religious sphere, and that void was partly filled by the Salafis. During the Nasser era, they also continued their publishing enterprise, but with even less competition than before. One interesting anecdote from the time, for instance, is that the first major international conference on Ibn Taymiyyah that took place in Damascus in 1958 to celebrate the unification of Egypt and Syria. That's interesting, right? To celebrate what was seen at the time as an Arab nationalist project, Ibn Taymiyyah would be the figure that would kind of link the two countries together. And you know that Ibn Taymiyyah was a Syrian who spent part of his life in Egypt, was jailed in Egypt, so you know he was seen as a symbol of that rapprochement. But the fact that the figure of Ibn Taymiyyah would take so much importance is also a sign of the times. So as I said, right, they continued their publishing enterprise, but it was even less competition than before. And Salafi spaces became the only non-state religious spaces available in the country. That explains why the Egyptian religious revival of the late 1960s sprung from Salafi spheres. It is a fact that most of those would become the leaders of the 1970s Islamic organizations in Egypt had their early religious socialization as Salafis, either within Ansar al-Sunnah or Ansar al-Sunnah mosques, or within mosques pertaining to another organization called Al-Jama'iyya al-Shar'iyya, which in the 1960s had also adopted a clear Salafi outlook. More than an Islamic revival, this was a Salafi revival. And as Salafis, many of these activists were initially more focused on questions of correct creed and Islamic behavior than they were on questions of politics. And this is obvious from the student groups that emerge in Egyptian universities, the famous Jamaat Islamiyya, which actually only became politicized during the second half of the 1970s, and especially after Sadat's famous trip to Jerusalem in 1977. Before that, their demands concerned gender segregation, stopping classes for prayer, or removing Sufi content from religious classes. Here, I think that there's actually some kind of historical problem in the literature carving that period. Most of that literature reads the 1970s decade retrospectively from Sadat's assassination in 1981 and analyzes that decade as leading eventually to the assassination of Sadat. And by doing so, it emphasizes the figure of Said Qutb as the main inspiration for the activists of that decade. And yes, I'm not debating that the writings of Said Qutb had importance. They did have a major importance in the 70s, but only at a later stage, and on a generation whose religious understanding was already informed by a Salafi vision. Let's look at the timeline here. It is only in 1973, 1974 that the largest group of Muslim Brotherhood detainees were released from prison. And this is when Said Qutb's writings became known to a larger audience. So the 1970s generation was already active on campuses by then. There were two consequences here. First, that activist generation, as a result of Said Qutb's influence at a second stage, as I said, yes, it did become gradually politicized, mixing its early Salafi vision with some of Qutb's political ideas. And that produced a brand of political Salafism that was, at the time, an entirely new thing. Breaking from the old Salafi grammar of action that I mentioned earlier, right? And the same thing happened exactly at the same time in Saudi Arabia with the birth of the Sahwa, which was the subject of the book I did before that one. Second, the Brotherhood, when they came out of jail in 73, 74, they were actually shocked to discover that a new generation of activists had emerged in their absence. And they would direct all their efforts at trying to co-opt that new generation of activists to revive the Brotherhood. And to do so, they would themselves have to adopt a clear Salafi outlook. This is the moment when, basically, Muslim Brotherhood members started growing beards. I mean, again, Hassan al-Banna did have one, but many brothers in the 40s, 50s didn't have one. So that is the moment when, again, they felt that they needed, not just in their appearance, by the way, but in what they would say and how they would present their project, they would feel the need to use Salafi references that would speak to that generation. The Brotherhood ended up being reborn, but with a Salafi element within it. And from the 80s and 90s, the Brotherhood would become increasingly divided on the question of Salafism, with a growing Salafi wing, especially among a new generation of religious figures, such as those that I've mentioned at the beginning of my talk, Safwat Hijazi, Raghab al-Sirjani. And on the other hand, as opposed to those, the old generation of scholars of the Brotherhood, such as Muhammad al-Ghazali or Yusuf al-Qaradawi, who actually wrote against the influence of Salafism in those decades. And you have two books, actually, from al-Ghazali from the 80s, denouncing what he sees as the creeping influence of Salafism. So it was indeed a debate within the Brotherhood then. By the late 2000s, the leadership of the Brotherhood was clearly leaning towards the Salafis. And that was another sign of the growing Salafi hegemony. This is what my friend, the deceased Hossam Tamam, some of you who follow Egypt probably know his name, and he left this in 2011. He was one of these Egyptian scholars who really provided an enormous amount of study to that question of political Islam in Egypt in the 2000s and really brought up a lot of new things. So Hussam in 2010 wrote an article which he called Tasalluf al-Ikhwan, right, on what he called the Salafization of the Brotherhood. And he was looking at these types of phenomena within the Brotherhood. So let me go back to the late 1970s and leave the Brotherhood aside for now. In 1981, that decade, yes, did end with activists identifying with what I would call a radical politicized Salafi worldview. Those are Al-Jihad and Al-Jama'a al-Islamiyya, the famous two groups that killed Sadat. Well, they did kill Sadat in 1981, yes. And that led to a widespread repression of all activists then, as well as a change of era with the coming to power of Mubarak. And Mubarak, as you know, would stay in power for the next 30 years. The Mubarak era would see Salafism continue its process of religious hegemonization. During the 1970s, Salafism had become the dominant idiom within Egypt's religious activist milieu. From the 1980s, Salafism would gradually become a mass phenomenon, reaching all parts of Egyptian society at large. That is the difference between the 70s and what happens from the 80s. And what happened from the 80s was the result of a number of dynamics, which I'll mention briefly here. First, in the late 70s, the first grassroots activist Salafi organization had been established. And it was called first Al-Madrasa Salafiyya, the Salafi school. And later on, Da'wa Salafiyya, the Salafi call. That organization was created by members of the Alexandrian branch of the student Jama'at Islamiyya, who were unhappy with the decision of many other Jama'at Islamiyya members to join the Brotherhood. In contrast, the founders of the Da'wa Salafiyya were hoping to bring Salafism back to its original grammar of action, purification and education, while shunning any political involvement, and thus to break from the politicization that Salafism had undergone in the 1970s. What made them different from Ansar al-Sunnah, though, told you that there was another Salafi group that was organized since 1926. So what's the difference with the new guys? What made them different then is that they had learned from their years as student activists a number of things, which they took with them. While Ansar al-Sunnah, which at that point had become a pretty sleepy institution, well, Ansar al-Sunnah was more akin to what I would call a traditional league of ulama, Rabitat al-Ulama, which is a common form of organization in the Muslim world, right? So Ansar al-Sunnah had become kind of a sleepy league of ulama. The Da'wah Salafiyya was designed as a grassroots preaching movement with a relatively complex architecture resembling that of the Muslim Brotherhood to some extent. And the Da'wah Salafiyya even has a guide, as you know, and he's called the Qayyim, right? He's the Salafi equivalent of some kind of murshid, right? They use Qayyim, by the way, to tell you the story, because Qayyim was the title given in the old days, in the medieval times, to the rector of a school, right? So Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyya his name comes from, he's the son of the Qayyim of the madrasa founded by Ibn Jawzi, right? Hence the name, right? So the name Qayyim is important because it's founded in Qayyim, and it's an old name. That refers to someone who heads a school. And as I told you at the beginning, they were called the Salafi school. So they took on that. But he kind of acts as a mentor of the group in ways that are certainly different from the Brotherhood. And I'm not claiming that it's the same, but they also have their guiding figure, right? And the new methods of mobilization that the Da'wah Salafiyya adopted from its student years explain in large part why, within 3 decades, the Da'wah Salafiyya became the largest Salafi group in Egypt, with a membership only second in number to the Muslim Brotherhood. In addition to the Da'wah Salafiyya, smaller Salafi groups, sometimes more politicized, continued to exist during the Mubarak era. So what we had was a blooming grassroots Salafism here, right? With one central group, the Da'wah Salafiyya, which was bigger than all the others, and then smaller Salafi communities, some of them, continuing the kind of more politicized Salafism of the 1970s. There are 2 reasons for this blooming of Salafism under Mubarak. The first has to do with what I would call the political economy of Salafism during those years. I'm sure you've noticed, and you've probably been surprised, that I haven't mentioned Saudi Arabia much yet in that talk. And that is actually on purpose, because I believe that the role of Saudi Arabia in the development of Egyptian Salafism is actually largely overrated in the academic and non-academic literature. Yes, Saudi Arabia did play a role. I'm not denying that they did. Of course they did. But they did at certain moments, right? One of those moments, actually, was not the one you would expect. It was in the 1920s and 30s, when Ansar al-Sunnah was founded, and King Abdulaziz was trying to normalize what in the days was called Wahhabi Islam, Salafism, Saudi Islam, whatever you want to call it, you know, just after he'd conquered Medina and Mecca, right? And you know that there was a hostile reaction from many parts of the Muslim world, because as in the times of the Ottomans, the Wahhabis or the Salafis were seen as extreme, right? So he was trying to make himself known and make his Islam known and make himself normalized, which led to him supporting certain groups such as Ansar al-Sunnah in Egypt. But what's interesting is that this is a non-yet oil Saudi Arabia. It's not the oil money at the time. It's 20s and 30s. It's not huge sums, but he's sending money grants to Ansar al-Sunnah, indeed. And helping them with manuscripts, which is crucial, right? Because what Ansar al-Sunnah does, remember, is publishing books that are not found in Egypt. And the Salafi networks going through Saudi Arabia, and especially the Hijaz, would play a big role in providing Ansar al-Sunnah with some of these medieval books that they would later publish to constitute the 20th century Salafi corpus. So yes, there was Saudi support at some moments. Yet, for instance, in the 1970s, the Islamic revival that I described was actually Salafi for the reasons that I explained. And as you could see, those reasons happened before Saudi Arabia exerted any influence over it. Right? It was the events of the 40s and Nasser coming to power and the elimination of the other groups. You know, Saudi Arabia was not involved in any of this. So the 1970s revival was Salafi before the Saudis could influence it. Not saying that the Saudis didn't try to influence it afterwards, especially after 1973. But it was already Salafi, right? And this is also where, you know, I think some of the historiography is problematic. So going back there, right, after the 80s, the role of Saudi Arabia, to me, in the Gulf, would become a bit more clear, right? And that role would be to make Egyptian Salafism economically sustainable by allowing Salafis to connect to a booming economic space. And that would help solve one of the issues that Salafis face in a country like Egypt. Because their conservative views prohibit them from entering many careers. When you're a Salafi, you don't want to work for a secular state. So you can't have a state job. In Egypt, it's pretty common to have a state job. Anyway, even if you decided that, well, I really need that state job, they probably wouldn't take you as your bid. So you wouldn't be accepted the way you look. If you're a Salafi, you would also avoid service jobs because you could be in contact with the other gender. And so that would put you in situations that you would not accept as a Salafi. So basically what you have then, you know, the preferable way of earning a living for a Salafi is business, as it is halal business, of course, right? Business and things that are halal. And the Gulf provided them with such halal business opportunities, either because they would go to the Gulf or because they would do business with Saudi companies from within Egypt. And many of these Salafis did import-export with Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. They did these types of things. So they would use those connections. Here again, I would partly disagree with the dominant narrative that sees Egyptian Salafism as a result of Egyptian worker migration to the Gulf. I'm not denying that this happened. Of course, you know, you did have Egyptians who went to work in the Gulf and came back as Salafis. Not denying that there plenty of cases. But at the same time, we shouldn't forget that many of those who actually went were Salafis before they went. And it was being Salafi that opened careers for them in Saudi Arabia, because they could connect to that network. So again, I think here, again, you know, the story has been a little bit unbalanced, right? So my argument here is that the Gulf, more than creating the Egyptian Salafi phenomenon, made it economically sustainable, right? And I think that was crucial in the blooming of Salafism in those years. Now, let's look at the second reason, which I believe explains the Salafi boom during the Mubarak era. And that second reason is the regime's strategy of considering the Salafis as a lesser evil in comparison to the Brotherhood and to the other Islamist groups. Though the Salafis would sometimes face repression, they were generally less persecuted, and they actually sometimes benefited from the benevolence of the security apparatus. And you have plenty of stories about how state security, Amn al-Dawla, would help Salafis take hold of a neighborhood, which it feared was too supportive of the Brotherhood or of the Jamaa Islamiyya. So those stories are plenty. That strategy became particularly obvious in the 2000s, when Salafis were granted the right to open a large number of satellite TV channels, broadcasting on Nilesat, the national satellite. And of course, that was something that the Brotherhood could never even dream of. Right? And that was completely impossible for the Brotherhood to do any such thing. So the fact that the Salafis could open those channels was a clear political decision. By the late 2000s, those channels were the most popular channels among Egyptian viewers. And watching them as one entered a shop or a home was unavoidable for anyone visiting Egypt in the late 2000s. I don't know if some of you have seen this, but I'm sure you have, if you've been there. So at that point, Salafi sheikhs like Muhammad Hassan, Abu Ishaq al-Huwaini, Muhammad Hassan Yaqub, they had become household names for Egyptians. By late 2010, we're just a few months before the revolution, Salafism had become so religiously hegemonic that the regime finally reconsidered its earlier strategy. In October 2010, 4 months before the revolution, the regime doesn't know that, of course. In October 2010, a suspension of broadcast was pronounced against some of the most popular Salafi channels, and a massive campaign denouncing Salafi influence was launched in the Egyptian press. And that campaign was, of course, aggravated in the wake of the terrorist attack on a Coptic church in Alexandria on Coptic Christmas in January 2011, 3 weeks before the revolution. In January 2011, a few week, 10 days after that attack, a magazine like Al-Musawwar, which is one of these Egyptian magazines, a little bit of tabloid in many ways, but quite read and has an audience. So Al-Musawwar would put, for instance, Yasser Burhami, the strong man of the Da'wah Salafiyya, on its front page with the title, Akhtar Rajul did the Masr, the most dangerous man against Egypt. That's interesting. That's a complete shift in the discourse, right, back then. Salafism had reached the apex of its influence, but the political tide was beginning to turn against it. And that is when the Salafis were saved by a miracle with which they had absolutely nothing to do. And that miracle is called the Egyptian Revolution. And when I say they actually had nothing to do with the revolution, it's even more than this. For the most part, Egyptian Salafis were fundamentally against the revolution, calling on their followers to stay at home during the protests. That was, for instance, the position of the Da'wah Salafiyya. For them, a revolution was worthless. As one of their sheikhs, Muhammad Ismail al-Muqaddim, then famously explained, what good can changing the ruler do if the society remains the same? The only Salafis who took part in the event were the smaller politicized Salafi groups that I mentioned before. And they did represent much smaller numbers, but they did take part, right? And those Salafis joined the politicized ones about 3 days into the revolution. You remember that if you have the timeline of the revolution in mind, starts on the 25th, on the 28th, the Muslim Brotherhood joins, and that is more or less when some of these smaller politicized Salafi groups join as well, at the same time as the Brotherhood, right? And among them, among these politicized Salafis who join, is Muhammad Abdel Maqsoud, who I mentioned at the beginning, the Salafi Sheikh from Shubra, quite a big name in Cairo, among the Salafi media of Cairo, and Hazem Salah Abu Ismail, whom I mentioned as well, who had become the revolutionary Salafi, we'll talk about later on. Right? So this is the moment when this tiny faction of Salafis joined. Yet the non-participation of most Salafis in the revolution had no impact on their popularity. Right? And as soon as the revolution succeeded, Salafis were among the first to reap the fruits of it. Within days of Mubarak's fall, massive Salafi conferences were organized across all of Egypt. Right? And Salafis couldn't do those massive conferences under Mubarak. Right? They had a margin of movement that was tolerated, but big conferences was not something that Mubarak would allow them to do. So now they could do this. And what they did, as soon as the revolution ended, was to organize in Alexandria, Damanhur, Aswan, you know, big Salafi conferences all across Egypt. Right at the time of the revolution, an attempt was made to unify all Salafis despite the differences between the more and the less politicized ones. two religious bodies were created. The first is called Majlis Shura al-Ulama, the consultative council of the ulama. And the second one, which I'll focus on here, which is more important, is called Lajnat al-Huquq wal-Islah, the Committee for Rights and Reform. That body is particularly interesting to study as an arena of intra-Salafi conflict. It was created right at the end of the revolution. It included members of the Dawah Salafiyah, politicized Salafis like Muhammad ibn Maqsood, and members of the Muslim Brotherhood Salafi Wing. It quickly appeared that each party was trying to use the body to further its own interests. The Dawah Salafiyah considered that since it was the country's largest Salafi organization, it should take the leading role in unifying the Salafis and that all Salafis should support it. In contrast, the politicized Salafis claimed leadership by putting forward their participation in the revolution, thus trying to compensate their smaller numbers with this kind of newfound legitimacy. Finally, the members of the Salafi of the Muslim Brotherhood were trying to channel Salafi support to the Brotherhood and use the committee for that purpose. It didn't take long for this initial attempt at unity to collapse and for each Salafi faction to go its own way. First, the Dawah Salafiyah. Let's look at it. The group had always shunned politics, told you that. But in the wake of the revolution, some of the members of the Dawah Salafiyah argued that the group now needed some form of political representation. After much internal debate, the Noor Party, Hizb al-Noor, was established in June 2011. And it received more than 25% of the votes in the parliamentary election a few months later, coming only second after the Muslim Brotherhood. And that showed the Salafis' impressive ability to convert their religious capital into political capital. After initial tensions and interrogations on the purpose of a Salafi party, and I won't delve into this here because that would make me talk too long, what happened is that the sheikhs of the Dawah Salafiyah turned the Noor Party into a lobbying arm for their religious organization. What I mean when I say lobbying arm is that the sheikhs of the Dawah Salafiyah never changed their grammar of action. They didn't believe in change from above, and they never envisioned the Noor Party as a vehicle to seize power or to establish an Islamic state. For them, the party's main function was to defend the interests of the religious association behind it, defend what they call Maslahat al-Dawah, right? And that was the whole theme that came in their discourse all the time. So for them, it was all about preserving the control over their mosques and creating the condition for an expansion of that religious control, right? I have sometimes compared this approach to institutional politics to that of the ultra-Orthodox Jewish parties in Israel, if you see that comparison, right? Because those parties also care first and foremost about the preservation and the expansion of their religious institutions, and they are not interested in exerting political power per se, which explains why they would make, you know, shifting alliances depending on who they can get the right promises from and give their votes or their voices in the parliament to the party or the leader that says, we're going to give you what you want. Hizb al-Noor would function very similarly, which will also later on explain many of the shifting alliances of Hizb al-Noor, of the Noor Party. So in that sense, I have argued that the Noor Party is not an Islamist party. And that takes us back to my earlier distinction between Salafism and Islamism, right? I think it's a misconception to analyze the Noor Party as an Islamist party, because it is not. And you cannot understand what they do if you see them through that lens. In any case, what I'm trying to get at here is that understanding the Noor Party's approach to politics is key to understanding why the sheikhs of the Dawah Salafiyah would end up turning Noor into a combat machine against the Brotherhood, right? Let me explain that point again. As I said, the sheikh's main focus is the preservation and expansion of their religious institutions, and they don't want to exert power. For them, the nightmare scenario is a Muslim Brotherhood electoral victory through which the brothers would end up seizing the state, and after they've seized the state, start converting their political capital into religious capital by appointing Brotherhood sheikhs and imams to every position in the religious sphere, thereby weakening the Salafi presence and putting the Salafi project in danger. Counterintuitively, the Salafis feel much more at ease with a secular regime, which at least doesn't compete with them in the religious sphere, which, in their view, is the only sphere that actually matters. This is key to understanding why the Noor Party Salafis did all they could throughout the 2 years and a half of the Egyptian transition to undermine the brothers. They run against them in the parliamentary elections of late 2011. In the presidential elections of May 2012, they decided not to present a candidate, and that's coherent with not wanting to exert power. But they also decided not to back Mohamed Morsi, and instead they opted for another more liberal Islamist candidate, Abdelmonim Abul Futuh, former MB member who'd left because he was on a more liberal line. Obviously, they didn't do this out of love for Abul Futuh, whose religious views they shared even less than Morsi's. But Abul Futuh was the only candidate carrying somehow the Islamic label that had any chance of winning. And if he had won, he would have been a weak president, which was perfect for Salafis, who would be the only cohesive group supporting him, thereby being able to instrumentalize him for their own purposes. When Abul Futuh failed in the first round, and the second round turned out to be between Mohamed Morsi and former Mubarak Prime Minister Ahmed Shafiq, Noor Salafis felt that they had no other choice if they wanted to maintain credibility with their base to support Mohamed Morsi. And they called for a Morsi vote, finally, at the very end. Yasser Burhami, though, but at the same time, as I said, the sheikhs obviously preferred a Shafiq option, right? So now they were torn between what they could say and what they actually preferred, right? And it would have not sounded good to their base to support the guy who was the former Mubarak prime minister, who was a known secularist, right? So they called for a Morsi vote, but in the days before the announcement of the results, you know, famous visit from one of the big sheikhs of the Da'wah Salafiyah, Yasser Burhami, was made to Ahmed Shafiq to tell him that in the end, you know, his victory was desirable and that, of course, if he was to win, the Salafis would be behind him. Eventually, of course, a year into the Morsi presidency, as you know, the Noor Party supported the military coup against Morsi. And if you remember the famous speech by Abdel Fattah al-Sisi on the 3rd of July 2013, you remember he's speaking and behind him there's a bunch of people sitting. There is the Sheikh al-Azhar, there is the Coptic Pope, there is the representative of Tamarrut, the youth group that supported the coup or supported the demonstration that led to the coup. And Gal El Murra, representing Hezb al-Nur. The Noor Party is there, right, in that picture. This all shows you how the Noor Party, with its almost 120 MPs, turned out to be 110. 120 is too much. 110. Turned out to be a headache for the Brotherhood during the whole of 2011-2013. Yet this was not the only Salafi headache for the Brotherhood. There was a second Salafi headache. Because late 2011 would see the rise of another major Salafi phenomenon, the so-called revolutionary Salafi movement, led by Hazem Salah Abu Ismail, the one I mentioned at the beginning of my talk, if you remember. As opposed to the Da'wah Salafiyah, Hazem was a politicized Salafi who had taken part in the revolution. He was also a former member of the Muslim Brotherhood. He had pertained to the Salafi wing of the Brotherhood, and later he had abandoned the organization. Now Hazem was turning into a charismatic grassroots leader who never missed a protest on Tahrir. He was always there with his crowd. And he was gaining immense support among religious Egyptians, both Salafis and Islamists, while denouncing the Brotherhood and the Da'wah Salafiyah as political sellouts who had abandoned any commitment to the Islamic project. He was doing some form of Islamic populism, if you want. He's above all in what I would call an Islamic populist, right? But in the name of Salafism, again, using the same Salafi reference. More importantly, he was a presidential candidate who was ranked first in some of the polls in early 2012. And people who've been in Egypt at the time remember Hazem being absolutely everywhere. And this lasted for a few months in Egypt. You know, you couldn't avoid his picture. It was just everywhere. It's interesting how easily we forget, right? Because lots of people forgotten about that moment. But that was a Hazem moment in Egypt. The Muslim Brotherhood was thus facing a major Salafi competition coming from both the Da'wah Salafiyah and its party, Hizb an-Nur, and Hazem's revolutionary Salafi movement. And this had two important consequences on the Brotherhood's behavior. First, the brothers started relying massively on Salafi religious figures, both as a way to appeal to the broader Egyptian public, but also as a means of countering the Salafi criticisms directed against them. The religious figures of the Brotherhood Salafi wing were now taking center stage. In addition, the Muslim Brotherhood made alliances with some of these smaller politicized Salafi groups that I mentioned, such as the one led by Muhammad Abdul Maqsood. And Muhammad Abdul Maqsood would become a frequent speaker at Brotherhood events, as in the story I told you again at the beginning of the talk. This would continue throughout the Morsi presidency. And just 2 weeks before the coup, on the 15th of June 2013, Morsi was presiding a major Salafi conference organized in Cairo's stadium to support jihad in Syria, right? And present were all the pro-MB Salafis, either from the Salafi wing or from all these politicized Salafis who decided to side with the MB, but also figures from Saudi Arabia, such as Mohammed Al-Arifi and others, who'd come directly from Saudi Arabia there. It's interesting that that conference was often cited by anti-Morsi figures as a proof of the alleged threat that Morsi represented for the country. And that was a part of the language elements that you'd find, you know, in the wake of the coup to justify why, you know, the coup was needed. So that kind of gave arguments to the other side. Second, I'm looking at two consequences here. So what's the second consequence on the Brotherhood's behavior? Well, the second consequence was that I moved too quick on the second consequence. I was kidding. No, I just wanted to stress again with you something here before moving to the second consequence. That, again, let me stress that this was not what many had expected, right? That Morsi would end up being surrounded by Salafis, right? I mean, most MB specialists would have thought, like, again, someone like Yusuf al-Qaradawi would play a major role in the post-2011 MB religious configuration. I mean, he was, in the end, as I said, the global mufti. He was the most well-known figure of the Brotherhood. And yet, the Salafi climate that was prevailing then made him completely sidelined. And he actually protested against it. And, you know, he was not happy with the events, was going on in Egypt. Second, so I'm going to my second point and the second consequence. The Salafi competition to the MB also impacted the decisions made by the MB. And that would have far-reaching consequences. First was the decision made in late March 2012 to present a candidate to the presidential election, despite the fact that the Brotherhood had promised throughout 2011 that they wouldn't do that as a way of reassuring the country's non-Islamist forces. Here, the pressure exerted by Hazem Salah Abu Ismail and his presidential campaign played a major role. And obviously, the Muslim Brotherhood did not know that he would be excluded from the race then. The Muslim Brotherhood generally feared that this uncontrollable maverick, who, you know, claimed to carry with him the Islamic project, would eventually be elected, because he would be a nightmare for them. They would have no control over him. There would be an Islamist president, so they would, you know, get the blame if anything went wrong. And so at some point they decided that if there was to be an Islamist president, then it would be better if it was one of them. And so they decided to run. That was not the only reason, but that was, I think, the main reason why they decided to run then, breaking the promise that they had made a year before. And again, that was a big thing when they decided to break their promise. That obviously, the fact that they run eventually opened the way to the standoff with the army, right? Because that was kind of a red line that had been set by the army from the beginning. The second consequence here was the decision by the Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood to adopt a heavily Islamicized constitution. And that was in December 2012. And by adopting that constitution, by relying on the Salafi votes in the Constitutional Assembly to make up a majority, despite the decision of most non-Islamist members of the Assembly to boycott the vote. That was in part the result of the religious bidding game between brothers and Salafis, in which the brothers was constantly under threat of being accused of being insufficiently committed to Islam. That was in part also the result of the sense of false security that being able to constitute a majority with the Salafis gave to the brothers. And the irony is that the Noor Party backstabbed the brothers as soon as the constitution was adopted by joining the opposition and the front that was forming with the National Salvation Front at the time. And right after the constitution, the Noor Party would move towards the opposition and eventually form some kind of united front and end up backing the coup. That would bring down Morsi. So the constitutional moment was central in that development. It is the moment when the non-Islamists feeling existentially threatened by the new constitution, broke with institutional politics, and decided that the only way for them was to knock at the doors of the barracks and get the army in. So let me conclude here what has been a long and dense demonstration. What I've tried to show is how and why the religious hegemonization of Salafism happened in the decade until 2011, and how this affected the post-2011 political dynamics. I think this is a crucial element that has not been sufficiently taken into account. For instance, in the now common comparison between the political trajectories of Egypt and Tunisia in the wake of 2011. In Tunisia, it is in part the weakness of Salafism that allowed the Islamist party in Nahda to be the sole representative of Islamic politics and to adopt a centrist strategy. In the Egyptian configuration, with the dominance of Salafism in the religious sphere and all the consequences that it had, something similar was highly unlikely to happen. I would say a couple of last words, but I won't be long, on the post-2013 Salafi configuration in Egypt. There is no doubt that Salafism remains a strong religious discourse in Egypt. I think the discourse remains, you know, has still a lot of prevalence. But the post-revolutionary politics have cost Salafi figures and movements a tremendous lot. And I think now we should distinguish between the discourse and many of these elements of the Salafi discourse that have been pervasive in the Egyptian religious sphere for so long that they are still very much there, and the actors, the Salafis themselves or the movements, that have lost enormously from the post-coup era, despite the fact that they backed the coup, by the way. They backed the coup, but Sisi was not kind to them in the end. They're not in jail, which, you know, these days in Egypt is quite a good thing. I mean, few Islamic actors can say that they're not in jail at this point. But their ability to protect maslahat al-da'wah, you know, the interest of the preaching movement at this point, are really weak. They've maintained some of their mosques, but they have no opportunity for expansion. They have no satellite channels. I mean, all of these tools that they had back in the days are gone at this point. We'll see how this... what this produces in the long term, right? At this point, what I can say again is that Salafist discourse is still strongly rooted in the Egyptian religious sphere, but again, its main actors and figures at this point have been considerably weakened. Of course, their supporters themselves also have turned away from them quite a bit, right? I think many of the Salafi supporters couldn't really understand what the Salafist leaders were doing. I think, you know, many of these genuinely, you know, committed Salafis who believed that this was a project that was going to save the Ummah, and then saw their sheikhs, you know, taking one side and then the other, and then shifting. And of course, the sheikhs had the logic for it. They knew, they thought they knew what they were doing. But again, that was not something that their followers understood very well. I'll finish here, and thank you.
Thank you very much, Stefan. By the way, I'm going to sit here, and I think we can do the Q&A from here. We'll just try and speak up.
Was I too long?
Not at all. It was absolutely fascinating, and I can't wait to read that book.
Thanks.
So if you look away, I'm going to hack into your computer and extract the file. I mean, you're doing at least three big things in this project. One thing is you're chronicling a very important period in Egyptian history, the sort of time around the 2011 revolution. Secondly, you are identifying and writing the history of a previously almost uncovered strand of Egyptian social and religious history, namely the Salafi movement. And in doing so, you are setting off a series of historiographical earthquakes. And we can debate how high they are on the Richter scale, but some of them are pretty significant. We'll go into that, I think, in the Q&A. But I want to just kick off the discussion by abusing my privilege and asking you about the kind of the transition from Saudi to Egypt in your kind of intellectual, personal intellectual journey. So my question is, what was the most surprising things that you discovered about Salafism as you entered a new country? And relatedly, this goes more to sort of the process of research. Like, what ways was doing research in Egypt different from doing research in Saudi Arabia?
Thank you. Thank you, Thomas, so much for your kind words and for the questions. Well, the research was very different in a way. Yes. In Saudi, there was too little. In Egypt, there was too much. In Saudi, it was very difficult to get people to speak. And when you managed to get a source, you were so happy with it that, you know, and it would pose, you know, methodological problems, because you would always have to find a second source, and that was difficult when you wanted to write. I mean, oral history has rules. You cannot just quote some guy. You need to have enough. And Saudi Arabia, the difficulty was getting enough, right? And that took me quite a bit of effort. Egypt is a country. Everyone talks all the time. And all these guys produce books. I mean, you know, there is even a genre, you know, the memoirs of an Islamist is a genre in Egypt. So people talk and tell a similar story in 10 different ways. So with Egypt, the difficulty is the huge amount of material, right? Which is what that project took me 10 years. I mean, 11, actually. And because there's so much. Because, you know, all of this, the thing is, you know, you need to collect hundreds and hundreds of books. You know, there's so many people you can interview. I was lucky to be doing the interviews, basically most of my interviews from 2010 to 2013. Which was the best moment, because you could speak to anyone, right? It was, of course, people were busy with the revolution, and you have to forgive them for that. But when they could get a moment of the revolution, they would tell you what you wanted, because they there was no state security watching over your shoulder anymore. So people felt a sense of security that they had never felt. So people told you very openly what they thought, it was an interesting experience. I mean, and very different from the one I had in Saudi. Of course, the difficulty was that after 2013, then the field became closed, because as soon as the military regime came, it became increasingly difficult to do field work. I mean, many of the guys in the book are in prison or in exile at this point. Only the core group of Salafis remain in Egypt, but they're convinced that they're going to be next. I mean, you know, even the Dawah Salafi guys did everything right. They backed Sisi for every presidential election. They come up with signs for Sisi. But they know that when the regime needs a scapegoat, they're next in line. You know, and the regime's going to need a scapegoat at this point, because the Muslim Brotherhood scapegoat is losing steam at this point. You know, no one, kind of the big Muslim Brotherhood conspiracy doesn't look so big anymore at this point. So you'd need to find a new conspiracy, because these types of regimes only live off conspiracies or imagined conspiracies. So the Salafis know that they're in a position where they are very scared at this point. So you can still see the ones who are abroad, but again, they might be disconnected from the field, which is why I'm also focusing very much on the pre-2013 moment. Also because the post-2013 moment is a moment when politics are dead in Egypt these days. I mean, there's really not much to study, really. I mean, there is to study, I'm not saying this. But what I'm saying is you know, the kind of, you know, I mean, it's a different thing today. You have to study the regime, because the regime is where it happens. There's no institutional political arena worth studying. Maybe the parliament would be interesting just to understand, you know, how the security services, you know, are playing games by, you know, using MP coalitions against each other. But there's no political parties anymore in Egypt. There's no, so it's a very different Egypt today. Back to your first question. Well, I started studying Egypt at the beginning because I was interested in trying to understand Saudi religious influence abroad. And I ended up concluding that it was really not as big as what people thought, right? I mean, that it was there, and I'm not denying that, you know, Saudi money did have a part. But there are plenty of endogenous Egyptian dynamics that explain why. And the regime is, if someone is to blame, in a sense, if blame needs to be given, I'm not blaming anyone, it's not my job, I'm an academic, but you know, if someone is in a sense responsible, right, for the rise of Salafism in Egypt, it's as much the Egyptian regime as it is the Saudis, because the Egyptian regime's played many, many games with the Salafis. So again, you know, it was all part of a configuration in which the Salafis were really smart, by the way. I mean, you might think whatever you want of their grammar of action, but it was coherent until 2011, and it always spared them from harm, allowed them to continue their project they were convinced would save the country, because Salafis are convinced of what they do. They're not, in a sense, I you know, take their claims for granted in that sense. I think they are believers in what they do, even when they do things that we don't understand. So I ended up discovering that Saudi Arabia's influence was not the big question. It was a side question in the end. Let's say that what was at the beginning, the core question, only became a side question at the end. The Da'wah Salafi has nothing to do with Saudi Arabia, for instance, right? Which is the biggest. They have nothing to do. The Saudis don't like that. I interviewed the guy who represented them in Saudi Arabia for 10 years in the 2000s, and the guy told me no one speaks to me. Like we're not taken seriously. There's one guy from the Da'wah Salafiyah who's called Muhammad Ismail al-Muqaddim, who has a lot of connections in Saudi Arabia as a person. He's taken seriously by Saudi Salafi scholars. But the Da'wah Salafi as an organization was not. The traditional Saudi scholars knew Ansar al-Sunnah from the old days, and their connection to Egypt was Ansar al-Sunnah. The regime didn't really like the Da'wah Salafi because it was an organized group, you know, it was a jama'ah. The very idea of Salafis becoming a jama'ah was not great news for the Saudi regime. They don't want this type of inspiration to get into Salafism and the Saudis trying to do the same thing. So in that sense, you know, what happened after 2011, for instance, you'd hear plenty of Egyptians telling you, it was common at the time, Salafis did 25% because of Saudi money. It's not true. I don't think there's much Saudi money there. I think they have a big constituency in the country, lots of rich people giving them money, lots of businesses, yes, maybe some Saudi money, but I don't think Saudi money was decisive. And when they back the coup in 2013, again, lots of people would tell you they did so because the Saudis told them to do so. So Saudis wanted Morsi out. I think they did it because they had their reasons, which I explained to you. They didn't like Morsi for their own reasons. they didn't need the Saudis to tell them not to like Morsi, right? Of course, then they converge with the Saudis, yes, in doing this. But again, convergence doesn't mean that these actors are necessarily, you know, there's not a Politburo of Salafism in Riyadh, who's a guy, you know, calling Salafis across the world to tell them do this and do that. You know? So yeah, I think Egypt is a good case of why there is not this Wahhabi conspiracy run from Riyadh.